You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly. Debt greases the wheels of every aspect of our economy, from the consumer debt held by individuals, corporate debt, and the deficit spending, which is essential to nation states. It's the instrument through which institutions like the International Monetary Fund have bludgeoned the countries of the Global South, and it's essential to war and militarism. Yet debt often conceals more than it shows, hiding relations of power and casting society's victims as profligate and morally deficient. How might we better understand debt, perhaps taking the long view, say, the last several thousand years? That's a task that celebrated anthropologist and anarchist David Graeber sets for himself in his new book, Debt, The First 5,000 Years, published by Melville House. Graeber teaches at Goldsmiths, the University of London, and is the author of a number of books, including Towards an Anthropological Theory of Value and Direct Action. He's currently in the United States and joins me by phone from New York City. David, why is the notion that people must pay the financial debts they accrue so deeply ingrained in our society?
It's a really interesting question, and really it's one of the reasons I wrote the book, was because it somewhat mystified me. One of the things that really impressed me was the degree to which the argument, you know, people have to pay their debts, could be used to justify things that just could never have been justified in any other way, particularly when I was involved in the global justice movement. We were doing campaigns about third world debt, and we could tell stories about poor people whose lives were completely destroyed, dying babies, and things that people would otherwise consider an atrocity. And, you know, even very liberal-minded people would say, well, that's terrible, but, I mean, surely you're not saying people aren't going to pay their debts. I mean, they borrowed the money. So that was really the problem I was trying to solve. And what I ended up concluding is that there's been a very, very long and deep process that has gone on for thousands of years, whereby our basic notions of morality and what it is to have a moral obligation, what it is to make a promise, have been kind of caught up in this financial logic, have been so corrupted by it that we can't tell the two apart.
I guess really the question that needs to be asked first is, what is wrong with the notion that, because it's kind of a common sense notion, that if you take out a debt, you should pay it? Why not?
Well, I mean, on one level, it makes obvious common sense, because a debt is just a promise. Now, if I make a promise to someone, I mean, it is a solemn commitment, and if people paid no attention to their promises, well, the world would be a very horrible place. On the other hand, a debt is a very particular type of promise, and the problem is that we've come to imagine all promises as if they were debts. But a debt is not just a promise. A debt is a promise that has become turned into mathematics, something, and once it has been turned into mathematics, you can precisely quantify what someone owes, it becomes impersonal. It becomes detached from the quality of the relationship of the people who have made promises to one another, and as a result of that, it becomes detachable, so that, like, if I make a promise to you, you can't turn that promise over to a third party. But with a debt, because it's impersonal, you can. So it's when you get morality caught up in that kind of mathematical logic, that terrible things can start to happen, obviously, particularly when you add interest to that. And what I discovered is that it's not a natural transformation. It's not like there's something about the nature of promises that makes us want to turn them into math. Quite the opposite. That forcing promises into that kind of mold, where it seems that, you know, debts and obligations and promises are all just kind of the same thing, really only happens through the medium of violence. Historically, it's always been in context of either potential violence or violence that leap can be made.
What do you mean by that? Give us an example, perhaps.
Okay. Well, one of the great mysteries that have plagued historians, economists for a long time has been the origins of money. One of the things that I discovered in my research is not only that, as an anthropologist, we've always known that there's something wrong with the conventional account. You know, once upon a time there was barter, and then barter proving inconvenient, people had to invent money as a kind of medium of exchange, and gradually credit systems come out of that. Now, we'd always known that was wrong, because we've never actually been able to find any place in the world where people use barter for everyday transactions. However, what I discovered is it's kind of, it's not just wrong, it's backwards. credit systems come thousands of years before you have actual cash, at least in the sense of coinage. And barter, when it does occur, usually happens when money systems had existed and they break down, say in Russia in the 90s. All right, so if the problem isn't how do you go from this inconvenient form of exchange barter to the invention of money, how do you go from credit systems to the invention of money? Well, you're talking exactly what I said. How do you go from a promise? And, you know, in most organic communities where people know their neighbors, that's the way things work. You wouldn't trade with your neighbor by swapping things like economists fantasize. You know, they have something you need. You ask them for a favor. A lot of parts of the world, all you have to do is praise somebody else's possession, and they'll immediately give it to you. And they'll pretend it's just a gift, but, of course, you owe them a favor. So everybody owes each other favors. And these favors are, you know, broad. I contributed a cow to your sister's wedding. You'll contribute a cow to mine, or something sort of like that, something vaguely equivalent to a cow. How does that turn into numbers? Because once you have money, you have to be able to quantify how many chickens equals one cow, how many silver plates equals one beaver pelt. Now, that's the great question, quantification. And that's exactly the problem I'm looking at. How do you go from moral obligations to numbers that can be transferred to one another, from one person to another? Well, the answer is, if, say, I want your cow and for something, and I praise your cow, you'll give me the cow, or, and say you give me something back that's completely inadequate, three chickens, you know, I might say that you're a cheapskate and mock you, which is kind of a terrible thing to do in a small community, being mocked like that. Might hurt your feelings a lot, but, you know, I'm not going to come up with a formula for exactly how cheap I think you are, right? On the other hand, if, say, I mock you, you get mad at me, we're all drunk, and we end up in a fight, and my eye gets poked out. Well, that's where, in societies without systems of money, you do tend to get exact, because there are often these very detailed codes of, you know, for this type of injury, you pay 27 heifers. If you don't have heifers, what do you substitute? And that's when people are very likely to get exact, or be exacting, as it were. 27 heifers, or this means war. In situations where there has been violence, where there's potential for a feud. And in fact, that's what you get. I was very impressed by the Welsh and Irish early medieval law codes, where they actually had a money price attached to every single object that would likely be in someone's house, from the rafters to the silverware, even though actually there were no markets where you could buy those things. Nobody ever bought or sold them. They just used, but they had to substitute things if you had to pay a fine, if somebody insulted someone, injured someone. So that's one context where it's violence. Another context simply has to do with war and slavery. There's very often very complicated systems of money that are used to rearrange personal relations. In many societies, money is never used to buy things, but it is used to arrange weddings, pay people for favors, ritual sponsorship, or something like that. Now, again, in those circumstances, you might be transacting in people, but you're not buying and selling them. But once a war comes in, slavery, you tear people out of those social contexts in which they're normally rested, suddenly people actually become commodities. And some of the earliest forms of money, the earliest denominations of money, actually seem to have been slaves.
You started talking about how there is a notion within, well, within mainstream economics about the origins of money, which are actually quite inaccurate, that don't have a basis in any empirical evidence, particularly around the notion of money being created to replace economies of barter.
Yes.
Which is an idea found in Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations. Why is that idea still so powerful, given how erroneous it is? Why does the profession of economics hold on to it? What's its significance?
That's another thing I spent a lot of time thinking about, because it is incredibly stubborn. Adam Smith assumed that all societies which don't actually have money would operate by barter, direct swapping of things back and forth between neighbors. In fact, anthropologists have discovered that rather than 100% of societies without money being like that, 0% were. We haven't found a single one. Yet economists keep telling the story. If you open up an economics textbook, well, they used to say primitive people use barter. They can't say that anymore because it's been disproved so many times. So now they just they sort of say, imagine you didn't have money. What would you have to do? So they tell these little fairy tales. There seems to be this need to do so. Now, if you look at what actually happens, it becomes quickly obvious that a lot of the point of this fairy tale is to sort of map out the field of economics as if it has always existed, which is a bunch of people swapping things. And if you ask economists, actually, they'll often say, well, all economies are really barter economies. Money is just this sort of tech tool that we use to facilitate barter. I actually found a couple examples telling examples for the book of how barter between strangers actually takes place, because neighbors don't engage in barter, but people do sometimes barter with strangers. And it's the last thing on people's minds is getting the best possible deal between chickens and cows. In fact, if you meet up with strangers, it's either because they're people that you don't really know, don't trust, and there's incredible tension, there's possibility of war, but there's also sexual intrigue, you know? I mean, because, you know, imagine you're living in a society where there's only about 20, 30 people of around the same age and of the opposite sex that you actually know. Meeting up with strangers is very exciting. There's immediate affairs, people have fights, sometimes people kill each other and then remarry. There's all sorts of things going on. In some parts of Australia, for example, they've actually turned barter into this ritualized orgy where, like, women of one side attack the men, drag them off to the bushes, they have sex, they give them some cloth, the other ones come back and give them something else. It's about anything but, you know, a bunch of people sort of rationally thinking about how to get the most chickens for themselves. Now, this is precisely what I think reveals what the economists are doing. It's only when you create markets and cash that you have completely impersonal relations with each other. Now, where you can just not think at all about the person you're dealing with and only think about how to get as many objects as possible for yourself, get the best deal. What economists are basically doing is taking that kind of what they call rationality and what they think is the basis of human nature. And some of them, like the Austrians, actually make a great point of this. This is what people basically are. Others are a little less explicit. But they project it backwards as the cause of the very institutions that create that sort of behavior. It's almost like saying that the game of chess was invented because people have some natural desire to checkmate one another's king, so therefore you invented chess. So, in a way, I think the ultimate purpose they have is to run away from what the real role of economics is. Economics claims to be an empirical science that studies human behavior. Thus all the equations, and a lot of their authority comes from claiming to be a science. Now, therefore, that story is very important because it sort of maps out the ground for the science in advance. However, you know, if they were really a science and they make constantly non-predictive predictions, you know, if they constantly say this is how people will behave, it's wrong, you would think they would adjust their hypotheses. That's what actual scientists do. In fact, what economists are doing is the work of what markets have been doing for centuries, which is teaching people to behave in certain ways. In order to be able to do so, they have to some degree, deny that's what they're doing and claim to be a science. So they're caught in the circular loop.
David Graeber is my guest. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. My name is Sasha Lilly, and we're discussing his book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years. So it seems that one of the elements that is being obfuscated in some way by mainstream economics making this parallel or basically presuming that the economic system that we live under is really just a system of barter is to make the sphere of production and exchange seem like some independent entity that is off doing its own thing separated from the state. And you argue that actually This is really erroneous. And of course, this division between markets and the state is not one that's just posited by mainstream economics, but actually often the left gets very caught up in seeing the markets and the state as somehow polar opposites to each other. So why are they not?
Well, exactly. I think ever since probably the early 19th century, all the great political debates have been, you know, free market versus social welfare state. And the argument has always been that these are essentially opposed principles. You have state bureaucracy, you know, according to the libertarians, is ultimately based on coercion and violence, and this goes back to Herbert Spencer, at least, in the 1830s and 40s. Or you have the market, which is the land of contract, and, you know, freely contracting individuals for good or for ill. Now, the remarkable thing, again, is that all historical evidence shows that these are not dichotomous principles that exist apart from one another, but that they only exist in relation to one another. If you find societies that don't have states, almost invariably they don't have impersonal markets of the sort that are always assumed to be opposed to them. And there's every reason to believe that markets, in the sense of markets operating on cash, of impersonal markets, really are a product of states, and specifically a side effect of state military operations. If you look at the invention of coinage, it happens not quite simultaneously, in the Aegean, on the Eastern Mediterranean, spreads quickly through the Mediterranean. It happens in northern India, and it happens in northern China. All around the same time. Apparently not influenced by each other. They're using different actual physical techniques to make the coins. Now, what are these coins used for? In almost every case, they seem to be used primarily to pay soldiers. And the more large empires spread, the more the use of coinage spreads. Empires go away, beginning of the Middle Ages, the coins disappear too. So what's going on? Well, it seems that the key factor here is taxation. It's always been a little bit of a mystery, if you accept the sort of Adam Smith version of where money comes from. That, you know, people barter with each other, it becomes inconvenient, they sort of spontaneously have to invent some kind of currency. Well, if that were the case, why did ancient kings demand taxes and money? It might seem obvious they want the money, but if gold and silver just sort of naturally became money, well, wouldn't the obvious thing to do be to just grab the gold and silver mines? And in fact, ancient kings generally did just that. They grabbed the gold and silver mines. So if the king already controls the gold and silver mines, he's got all the money he wants, what's the point of taking it, stamping your picture on it, giving it to people, and then saying, okay, everybody give it back again? Well, the only logical explanation is they're actually trying to create markets. The big problem, if you're an ancient king, is how to feed your soldiers. Because say you have an army, 50,000 people, say. Well, they're going to eat pretty much everything there is to eat in the vicinity of where they are within a matter of weeks. Either you're going to have to get 50,000 more people just to get food to them somehow, or you're going to have to figure out some way to get everybody else to supply them with food. Well, the easiest way to do that is to take gold and silver, which is, of course, the kind of thing that soldiers are going to have little bits of anyway if they've been looting and pillaging. Systematize it by taking it, stamping your picture on it, giving it to them, and then saying, all right, everybody in the kingdom now has to give me one of these back again. Suddenly, you've just employed all of your population as soldier feeders, or giving soldiers things they want, people. Now, markets crop up right next to military camps, and it happens over and over again. Someone did a study of the distribution of coinage in the Roman Empire and discovered almost all the coins they found are either in Italy itself, where a lot of the legions were stationed, or on the border where the armies were, where there were no soldiers. People didn't even really use Roman coins very much. So this pattern appears over and over again. Actual physical coinage tends to be a product of wars, empires, and governments. Governments create markets through intentional policies. They did the same thing in much of the Third World, the colonial empires, created by England, France, U.S., Belgium, and so forth. In almost every case, the first thing they did when they conquered a place was print money and then demand that everybody give it to them in taxes. It was a way of creating market.
You write in Debt, the First 5,000 Years, that human history has been, or at least known history, has been the history of two forms of money, virtual money and bullion. And you were just describing bullion. Perhaps you can tell us a bit more what virtual money looked like in societies that were not based around things like credit cards, such as in Mesopotamia or in the Middle Ages, and then explain why this transition between these two forms.
Sure. Yeah. Again, we tend to think that virtual credit money, the kind of money we use in everyday transactions, is something new. Sort of entering in this kind of brave new science fiction world where money takes this immaterial form. In fact, one of the really startling things I discovered in my historical survey is First of all, that credit money is the original form of money. Second of all, that there are cycles of history whereby some periods are dominated by virtual credit money. Other periods, people are actually using physical gold, silver, bronze, coins in everyday transactions. But even more strikingly, that the pattern of change seems quite uniform all the way across Eurasia. There really was one single kind of field of transformation. What the same things keep happening in China, India, and the Middle East, and by extension Europe, over and over again. Now, credit money in Mesopotamia, as I say, its original form, seems to come out of the administration of temples. A shekel, which is originally a weight of silver, which corresponds to a certain amount of grain, actually corresponds to a ration system, the amount that it would take to feed one temple worker two meals a day for a month. Now, at some point, and it seems to happen before our first written records, everybody starts using this administrative accounting system of how to keep track of grain, various products that are used in temples when they're doing exchange with one another. We don't know how it happened, but what we do know is that they were using some kind of system of account, because even though when people sold things to each other, they were using silver to keep track of how much things cost, they didn't actually make scales small, you know, fine enough. They actually had the technical capacity, but they didn't choose to make scales fine enough to weigh out the tiny amounts of silver that it would have taken to buy a hammer or a tunic or some everyday item like that. Instead, people seem to have just kept track of who owed what to whom. And there were various, if you're a merchant, there are these complicated documents called billets that sort of were like almost like letters of exchange that could circulate around. They were circulating IOUs, basically. But, you know, say you go into the bar in ancient Sumer, well, you have a tab. It's not an unfamiliar idea. People keep track of how much you owe. They notch some tablet of some kind, maybe a stick. And around harvest time, or some period where people would likely be flush of money or stuff, you know, you bring something in of the value of what you owe. And you can negotiate what. Usually it's grain, but you know, sometimes I'll take other stuff too. Similarly, there are expense accounts. So we already have a rather sophisticated credit systems, compounded interest rates, for example, for thousands of years before the actual invention of coinage.
And so what accounts for the shifts then between these periods of credit money and those where gold and silver bullion may be used as money?
It's a really interesting question, and it's not entirely clear. I mean, there certainly is a pattern. You can see that coins are invented, as I say, almost simultaneously across Eurasia. It has something to do with the rise of a new type of professional armies that hadn't really existed before, so that coinage eventually becomes systematized as a way of paying soldiers. When the empires fall, the coins vanish. But I think it's more complicated than that. I mean, the beginning of the Middle Ages, the gold and silver tends to get locked up in temples and monasteries again, and people go back to credit systems. For example, in the Middle East, I mean, already in Basra in 1000 AD, people are using checks for everyday transactions. Check is actually an Arab word. Paper money comes out of credit instruments in China around the same time. In Europe, they're using notched sticks that are broken in half called tally sticks. Now, why do they go back to virtual money? It's not entirely clear, but it has something to do with the rise of religious movements, which are, you know, when they first arise, really anti-war movements. Coins are caught up in the system of professional soldiers, but also of chattel slavery. You know, the armies are taking slaves, or taking the slaves, putting them in the mines where they produce more gold and silver to pay the soldiers. It becomes this kind of great loop. There are those who have called it the military coinage system. I would call it the military coinage slavery system. Somehow, in the Middle Ages, chattel slavery largely disappears. In their pockets here and there, but for the most part, it's wiped out. And you have to bear in mind that 40% of the population, say, of Roman Italy, appears to have been actual chattel slaves. Several hundred years later, nobody's a slave. And, you know, in a way, it's one of the great liberations of human history, even though we think of it as the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, as a series of disasters. And it's an interesting paradigm, I think, for how historical shifts happen. We don't know. These anti-war movements then become religions that are adopted by the empires in each case. and China, India, and Europe with varying degrees of success. But in that process, somehow the militarism dies down, the armies are disbanded, the slaves are largely liberated to one degree or another. So I think there was some kind of broad social movement that we don't really completely understand. Then, even more complicated, what happens around 1492, when, of course, gold and silver come back again, people get the idea that money really is gold and silver again, rather than credit relations. And large empires reappear. Chattel slavery reappears, of course. It's a period that's really only ending now, since 1971, when Nixon goes off the gold standard. It's like the cutoff point, if you have to choose one. Now, how did that happen? It's not entirely clear. In some ways, I think there's a lot of great historical ironies, because one of the things that sets off the whole thing is popular movements in China against the credit system, which is used by the government in various oppressive ways. People start create this kind of free market populism based on the use of silver, which is uncoined. It's coming out of these illegal silver mines. They create an alternative economy, and eventually the government gives in and says, okay, fine, we'll give up on the old caste system. We'll just create a new tax system where everybody has to pay in silver. And problem is, there wasn't much silver in China. They clean out all the mines pretty quickly. They clean out Japan in about 20, 30 years. And there's this huge thirst for silver in China. And that's interestingly, most people don't realize this, what made the Spanish and Portuguese conquests in the New World actually economically viable. Because Europe, you know, was flush full of gold and silver. They didn't really know what to do with it. But there was this endless market for it in the East. So almost all the silver that the conquistadors take out of the Americas ends up in China. This starts a gradual shift back towards metal-based economy.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm talking with David Graeber about the history and politics of debt. He is the author of Debt, the First 5,000 Years, published by Melville House. We have a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org. He teaches anthropology at Goldsmiths, the University of London, and amongst other books, he's the author of Towards an Anthropological Theory of Value and Lost People. David, you were talking about this shift in the modern era, approximately around 1450, where there was a turn away once again from virtual currencies and credit economies back to gold and silver. And as you say, this was an era of empire. Is there anything else that you would say characterizes this time, which is significant because in what you're arguing is it came to an end about 40 years ago?
Well, the central banking system that we have today, now it seems a rather innocuous thing, the Fed, the Bank of England, these are institutions which are, you know, charged with fighting inflation and maintaining employment, ostensibly. But if you look at their actual origins, they all go back to that alliance between sort of quasi-independent, politically independent financial class, or not just financial, but often industrial as well, basically the capitalists, and militarists. I think that this is something that Marx really didn't talk about very much, and is left out of most standard accounts of what capitalism is. The money that's actually used by capitalists with each other generally is government war debt, and the central banks sort of a way of channeling that. The story of how the Bank of England was created, I think it wasn't the first, it was the second actual central bank, but it became the paradigm for the model that exists in all countries in the world nowadays, is really telling. Essentially, the way it worked, a group of merchants got together and made a loan of £1.2 million to King William, who was fighting a war in France. They're always borrowing money to fight wars. What he did was, he said, all right, in exchange for this extremely large loan, I will give you a monopoly. You can call yourselves the Bank of England, and you have the right to take the money that I now owe you and to lend it to other people in the form of banknotes. Now, that's what British currency actually is. It still is. It's issued by the Bank of England, and it is a promissory note. If you look on a British bill, I actually have one in my pocket here because I live much of the time in London. Here's a 10 pound note. You have a picture of the Queen right here, and above her head it says in very small letters, I promise to pay the bearer the sum of 10 pounds. That's what paper money is. It is a promise by the sovereign to pay what is ultimately a war debt. So a circulating government debt. If the Queen ever actually did pay back the original loan, the currency system would disappear. Now, that system remains in place. I mean, if you look at the way that the Federal Reserve works, there's a lot more smoke and mirrors, but ultimately it's the same system. The difference is the British merchants in 1694 actually lent the money, to, you know, like silver, gold, to the king. I think it was gold, actually. Whereas Federal Reserve just sort of waves a magic wand and the money appears, but then they lend it to the federal government by buying treasury bonds. And ultimately, that's what dollars are. They are issued by the Federal Reserve, and they're circulating government debt. Now, much of that nowadays is held overseas, and people talk about, well, we have this terrible debt. We kind of imagine it's all owed to China. In fact, China has only gotten on the game very recently. They're playing an interesting game, but in a way, it's rather secondary. For most of our history, the countries that held U.S. Treasury bonds were, well, West Germany was the big one during the Cold War, but also Japan. Japan still does. South Korea, the Gulf states. What do all these countries have in common? Well, they all have American military bases. They're all under American military protection. Essentially, the U.S. Army sits across the world. If you calculate it, the rise of the deficit corresponds almost exactly with the rise of military spending. Much of that new borrowing is from overseas, but it's from exactly the people who the Army's sitting on top of. And the Treasury bonds are constantly rolled over. Every time they mature, rather than actually asking for the money back, they simply buy new Treasury bonds with it. So since they pay less than the rate of inflation, it's kind of a negative. People have described it as a tax. You could almost describe it as an imperial tribute system.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because much has been made on the left, as well as the right, about the U.S. being this debtor to these countries and its bonds being held by these overseas institutional investors. And on the left, it's been seen by some as an indicator that the U.S. as an empire is fundamentally weak. But could its debts, in fact, actually reflect its power?
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, it's protection money. Now, you can think of it in two senses. You can think of it as protection money in the mafia sense. You know, if you're Japan, the fact that the U.S., you know, owes you money basically is a shakedown system because, you know, the U.S. isn't going to pay, and how are you going to make them pay? They have their giant army sitting on your country. Or you can think of it as protection money in a more literal sense that, you know, they're hiring us as mercenaries to protect them against China or whatever other country they're worried about right now. It's a little bit of both. But, you know, you could easily make the argument that this is exactly how the empire works. We have an empire that doesn't claim to be an empire. I mean, any other time in history where you have a country with giant military bases all over many other countries, that has been referred to as an empire. We don't like to refer to it as an empire, but if we don't like to refer to it as an empire, obviously we're not going to refer to the money they seem to be giving us as tribute. So we call it debt.
Well, and as you mentioned a bit earlier, a pivotal moment in all of this seems to have been in August of 1971, when Richard Nixon decided to take the U.S. dollar off the gold standard in order to pay for the Vietnam War. Before then, a dollar was pegged to the price of gold. And then since then, the U.S. has, it seems to have ushered in a really new era in terms of the financialization of the economy, and yet the dollar has stayed central as the reserve currency, perhaps because of its imperial role.
Precisely. I mean, if you look at what the sort of world currency is at any given historical period for the last 300-400 years, it has been the currency of the primary military power. I don't think that's a coincidence. Now, in the case of Nixon, it's really quite interesting. The dollar was redeemable overseas, not in America itself, which actually shows the role of taxes, right? Because they can, if only dollars are usable in taxes, they don't really have to have anything to underpin the dollar in the country. However, overseas, the fact that only dollars can be used as taxes in the U.S. is insignificant. So they said, all right, overseas you can redeem the dollar for $35 an ounce in gold. problem was that at one point, both England and France started calling the U.S. on the debt, asking to redeem a lot of the dollars. At one point, apparently, the floor of the Bank of England collapsed under the weight of the gold they were getting from America. Once France actually started demanding the gold, it became a prospect of having to empty out Fort Knox. A lot of that, they were just trying to play around with various rooms under the Federal Reserve Building in New York, where they had these chambers where all these central banks have their gold reserves, and if there's an imbalance, they just move it from one room to another. Now, at one point, Charles de Gaulle said, no, this will not do. Give us the actual gold. And his successor, Pompidou, actually sent a battleship to New York Harbor in 71 saying, look, take the gold, put it in the ship, and send it to us. Nixon simply said, no. What are you going to do, nuke us? Which is, of course, the same thing with China now. I mean, in theory, the U.S. owes all this money to China, whatever that actually means. If China really tried to recall in any way that would upset the international financial order, you know, the U.S. would just do exactly the same thing. We don't really have to do anything we don't want to. It's not like China's going to send nuclear bombs to the U.S. over something like that. However, the paradoxical result of Nixon going off the gold standard was that instead of using gold as the ultimate reserve currency, banks started actually using treasury bonds. So we had, it actually reinforced the American empire, imperial system. Now, that's the thing that's only now really being seriously challenged.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're looking at an anthropological history of debt with David Graeber. His book is Debt, the First 5,000 Years. So, David, you write in Debt that throughout history, in periods where virtual money has dominated, and you would place us now in such a period, that during those times, institutions would be produced that would protect debtors so that the lenders and the powerful couldn't conspire to just exploit debtors to the maximum. But what we're seeing now is something quite different, which is that lenders through, you know, institutions like the International Monetary Fund can absolutely push debtors to the limit, whether it's imposing structural adjustment on the global south or through other mechanisms to basically just have their way entirely.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to ask you, looking back, how did those institutions that did protect debtors actually appear historically? Because the question you pose is, why did that happen in the past and is not happening now? But what were the forces that actually engendered these institutions in the first place? Were they set up by the rich and powerful? I mean, it seems sort of hard to imagine.
It's a really interesting question. And of course, one of the problems we have in history is that the voices of the people we now consider social movements are very hard to find. They're not the sort of thing that's likely to be written down on a cuneiform tablet, you know. If a king did sort of bow down to popular pressure, kicking and screaming, and make concessions to social movements, he wouldn't write that. He would write, you know, I, the great king, you know, owing to my benevolence toward the widows and orphans of my land, decided, you know, to do X. So we don't really know what the politics of the day was like. But, for example, in Mesopotamia, we get a sense of what happened. There were periodic debt crises. People would fall into debt. Say there was a bad harvest. Farmers would have to borrow grain. They would get trapped in debt traps. It became hard, classic phenomenon. It becomes harder and harder to get out. You start having to pawn your fields, your flocks. People start repossessing things. Of course, the more they repossess, the harder it is for you to make the additional payments. Eventually, you start losing everything. People would lose their children, it would become sometimes enslaved, sometimes debt peons, their wives, sometimes themselves. Now, these debt crises would threaten to destroy society because people started resisting. And the most common mode of resistance in much of the ancient world was simply running away. It took a lot longer to run away. If you're, you know, a shifting cultivator, you just sort of run instantly. That's why it's very hard to create a state. Where there's irrigation networks and people have put a lot of investment, you know, people won't run away until they're really hard-pressed. But eventually they will. They'll leave the irrigated area. They'll join nomad bands. Social order will start kind of falling into chaos. And kings would panic. Sometimes they would panic simply because there's nobody to serve in their armies anymore. Sometimes they would panic because they see everything falling apart. And they would declare periodic debt forgiveness. It often became the case in certain periods of Mesopotamian history that every king, the first thing they would do when they took power would be to declare a clean slate. All debts were forgiven. Sometimes debts in silver, commercial debts weren't forgiven, but debts in grain, consumer debt was. All debts were forgiven, and everybody gets to go home. I like to quote the Sumerian word amargi. It's the first recorded word for freedom in any human language, as a word for debt freedom. And it literally means return to mother, because all of the people who've been sort of taken off to serve in the households of the rich got to go home. Now, that became institutionalized as the Jubilee through the prophets, which again were the sort of voice of the angry poor in ancient Judea. And similar things happened in the ancient world. Often very explicitly revolutionary movements. The sort of great program throughout by Moses Finley, the great classicist, once said that there's basically one revolutionary program in all of antiquity, which was cancel the debts and redistribute the land. So there was intense pressure from below to cancel debts all the time. As I say, the great religions, Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, really start in a certain way as social movements and are caught up in anti-war movements. Confucianism was the same thing. Now, in almost every case, as soon as those religions become the sort of arbiters of economic life, first thing they do, again, is to put controls over debt traps, usually by eliminating usury. It was the most common one. The Buddhists were slightly different. They didn't actually object to lending money at interest. Instead, they created alternative institutions so that the first widespread use of pawn shops actually comes out of medieval China. They were almost invariably in Buddhist monasteries as a way to provide an alternative to the local loan shark. But the Confucians, who ran the governments and were somewhat suspicious of the Buddhists, also would do periodic debt cancellation. Now, in almost every case, it's because governments were suspicious of the mercantile classes, and but also because having a prosperous peasantry was critically important to them to keep the taxes coming in.
So perhaps it's too early to make a judgment about what's happening now, given that, you know, in historical time, being, say, 30 to 40 years into this new era is really, way too soon. But
40 years is nothing if you're talking about 500-year cycles.
Exactly. And yet, you write in Debt that this notion that there's a moral obligation that we all have to pay off our debts has been particularly pronounced in the United States.
Yeah.
And, you know, very much part of this country's culture. And yet, of course, the global financial crisis has, in some ways, you know, maybe only partially, but it's helped shift in some ways the ways that we see debt. And I wonder if you think that the time is really ripe for some kind of mass resistance against debt, whether it's, you know, coordinated refusal for students, for example, to pay their debts, given that student debt now eclipses credit card debt as the largest individual debt in the United States, or, you know, on a level of countries like Greece, you know, what if they decided to default? I mean, do you think that this is actually something that radicals should be taking up and encouraging?
Absolutely. I mean, it has to happen. And even the capitalist class is coming to realize that the existing order is just not viable. It's not going to work. In a way, we've been dealing with a series of continual debt crises since the 70s. At first, it was mainly concentrated in the Third World, which is, after all, where most people in the world do live. But nonetheless, you have, you know, they managed to keep it kind of apart from people in North Atlantic countries, the wealthier countries. But, you know, as soon as that really ended, and, you know, ultimately, people don't realize the global justice movement effectively won. The IMF, structural adjustment, all that was kicked out of East Asia, it was kicked out of Latin America. Most countries in the world don't deal with the IMF anymore, and are, incidentally, not undergoing austerity right now. Effectively, what they did was they took those, you know, horrific policies, and they applied them at home to Europe and America. Now, it's not viable. And historically, as I say, people have really been doing things almost exactly backwards. When you have a period of virtual credit money, what that means, it doesn't just mean that people are using immaterial means to make promises, financial promises to one another. It means that people come to understand that money isn't actually a thing. Money is a social relationship. It's nothing but a promise, an arrangement, an IOU, and arrangements can be rearranged and in a sense, invariably have to be. In a way, that sacred nature of debt is always something that really only applies between the rich and the poor. You know, poor people are constantly lending people, giving people, bailing people out, giving people gifts, which they dress up as loans, but really they're not. If you lend money to your brother, it's really often a way of sending saving face because he won't take a gift from you. Rich people, you know, that debt between two rich people is not the same between as a debt that a poor person owes to a rich person, and this has always been true in world history. If it's important players, they can work something out. I mean, sometimes they play games with each other and try to destroy each other, like Goldman Sachs did to Lehman Brothers. But, you know, ultimately, rich people can be extraordinarily generous and forgiving when dealing with each other. It's just with everybody else that debt becomes a sacred thing that, of course, has to be paid. Now, what we learned in 2008 was exactly that, that if, you know, virtual money is different. You can rearrange things. In fact, they made trillions of dollars of debts of the big players, people like AIG, vanish overnight through various forms of financial mumbo-jumbo. They could have done the same thing to ordinary mortgages. In fact, the irony is, if they had actually bailed out everybody, everybody's mortgage, that itself would have bailed out the banks. But they wanted to keep up that idea of the sacredness of debt between poor people and the financial elite, which increasingly became identical with the capitalist class themselves, since just about all capitalist firms were going into the financial business in one way or another. Now, I think that the movements we see around the world now are essentially saying, look, the cat is out of the bag. We understand what's going on now. We understand that markets don't really run themselves. We understand that debts don't really have to be repaid. If you're a big enough player, too big to fail, then something will always be worked out. But if the debt is now just a social arrangement or a political arrangement, well, if democracy is going to mean anything, it's going to has to mean that everybody has to weigh in on how this happens, how these promises are made, and how they can be renegotiated, since they actually are renegotiated all the time. That's what I think is going on in Greece and Spain, where you have these vast social movements around real democracy and focusing on the debt again. But take the example of Egypt. A lot of what happened in Egypt had to do with microcredit and debt. The reaction by Saudi Arabia is very telling. When they were afraid that the revolution was going to spread there, one of the first things they did, aside from beef up security forces, was to declare a jubilee of their own. They actually did universal debt forgiveness. And one of the first things the new Egyptian government did was to tell the IMF to go away. So there is a huge amount of mobilization around this, and I think it's a point where capitalism has really revealed itself to be extremely weak. It no longer can maintain the illusion that this is a system that runs itself. That division between market and state has essentially vanished. We realize that we're facing a sort of uniform enemy here. And I think it's almost inevitable that social movements begin to take advantage of this remarkable weakness of the other side.
Well, I'd like to end by just asking you about perhaps one of the more hopeful dimensions, although what you've just said is quite hopeful as well, in looking at debt that you pose in your book, which is that although our societies are very much structured around debt, the way we interact with each other on a daily constant basis actually tends to be, rather than capitalistic, communist.
Yeah. Communism is the basis of all sociability. Obviously, in order to say that, you have to have a slightly different definition of communism than that largely thrown out. But let's call it small-c communism. One of the reasons why we imagine all moral relations as debts is because we think of all transactions, all relations we have with one another, certainly all economic relations which involve transferring some kind of good or labor back and forth, as if they're matters of exchange. And economics teaches us to do this. But becomes a habit. I mean, even those people who are arguing against economists, a sociologist, will often say, well, no, it is an exchange, but it's a moral exchange. It's not a, you know, self-interested exchange. But, you know, a lot of what we do with each other isn't exchange at all. And I really think it's important that we sort of take the blinkers off our eyes and look around at what, how we actually live our lives. Gibson Graham, for example, a feminist economist, have long since pointed out that, you know, capitalism isn't the way we live most of the time. Most actions we do aren't profit-oriented. We just tend to figure have ways that we don't think about, you know, most of what we do every day, which has nothing to do with capitalism. But I, you know, try to take that a little more systematically, and I pointed out that, well, there is actual exchange. It can take the form of gift exchange, or it can take the form of commodity buying and selling. You have hierarchical relations, which are not reciprocal at all. You know, if you give something to a superior and inferior, often it's just taken to mean you're expected to do it again. But you also have communistic relations, and in a way, communistic relations are the most fundamental because all other relations are built on them. By communistic relations, I mean very simply from each according to their ability to each according to their needs. In fact, when people are cooperating with one another, it doesn't matter where. You know, if you're working for ExxonMobil or for DuPont or, you know, whatever name your evil capitalist corporation, you know, if I say, hey, hand me the wrench, the other guy doesn't say, yeah, what do I get? You know, you allocate resources in terms of who needs it and who actually can do what they can do. So communism, in a sense, is the essence of all forms of cooperation, but it's also the essence of all forms of sociability. I mean, if there's someone that I don't, you know, isn't my enemy, who I'm not actively opposed to, well, there is an assumption that on some basic level, of course, we will behave on the basis of from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs. That is, if the need is great enough, you know, I'm drowning. Throw me a life preserver, or the cost is small enough, you know, directions, do you have a light? Well, of course we're going to do that. We're not going to keep account. And in those relations which are most important to us, which are characterized by love and actual caring, well, we do the same thing. We take into consideration each other's needs. We take into each other's abilities, but you know, we don't actually keep account of who gave what to whom. And one reason we do that is because we assume that those relationships are going to be around forever. You know, your best friend will always be your best friend. You don't have to keep track of who's done who a favor. Your mother, it's always, well, your mother's not always going to be there, but you imagine relations like that as if they are eternal. They're always going to be there. Society itself is always going to be there, so you don't have to keep track of how many people have held doors for you and how many you've held doors for. So in that sense, almost all relations are founded on this assumption of communism. And in many societies, incidentally, you know, that idea of, like, you know, give me a light, extends to much more important things, food. There are many parts of the world that if you ask someone for some food, you basically can't refuse. I always like the story, there's this Maori story from New Zealand about this guy named Te Renga, who, I mean, it's probably apocryphal, but used to go around every day and, like, go by the beach and watch people fishing. And when they came back, he would say, wow, you got some squid? Wow, I love squid, you know. And, of course, they'd have to give it to him. He just do this every day and drove everybody crazy. So after about 5 years, they killed him. Because you can't actually say, no, I'm not going to give you the squid. So in a sense, like, you know, we're all communists. We're all already communists. And to me, I mean, rather than thinking of capitalism and communism as two counterposed principles, I think capitalism is simply a really bad way of organizing communism. Communism will always be here. What we need to do is to figure out ways to organize communism that will not make it turn into social hierarchies.
David Graeber, it's been a pleasure having you.
It's been great to be here.
My guest today has been anthropologist, anarchist, and writer David Graeber. He's the author of Debt, The First 5,000 Years. It's published by Melville House, and we have a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. He teaches at Goldsmiths, the University of London, and amongst other books, he's the author of Lost People. And you've been, of course, listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio, and it's the most reliable way to sign up for our podcast. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670, or visit us on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. I'd like to thank our engineer today, Erica Bridgman.